This episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code CASTOFKINGS at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hello everyone and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And I'm Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning into this podcast for the first time, you can find more of our episodes at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. Also find us on Facebook and Twitter at acastofkings. What we do here is we will discuss everything and spoil this week's episode of Game of Thrones, but we will not spoil anything from future week's episodes, and that includes the next time on previews that HBO shows. This week we'll be spoiling everything through Season 5, Episode 4, entitled Sons of the Harpy. Before we get to this week's episode, we got to correct egregious errors that we made in last week's episode. This is a weekly tradition that we do, where we correct things. So, John Robinson, I think you were the one that despite your Vanity Fair pedigree, you made a mistake last week.
Oh my gosh, I did. You were right and I was wrong. This never
let me just bask in that. Like if it was a film, I would be rubbing it all over my face and body right now.
Continue. A film?
Or just, you know, something like, you know, something that I could, like, a physical thing that I could rub on.
Okay. Yeah, so
if it was like a liquid or, you know,
I get it. I thought you said I thought you meant like
like shooting on film.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that doesn't make any
sense. I was envisioning like a roll of film.
That makes zero sense, Joanna Robinson.
All right, but what makes more sense is that Marjorie was in fact married to Renly. Our listener Pat Spanagel pointed this out to me. I made this mistake. I said they were just engaged, but no, they were married. So this is third time's a charm for Marjorie.
And I think third time's a charm for me getting something right that Joanna Robinson did not get right.
So. Wow.
Which by the way, for those who think I'm like gloating, this is only because 99% of the time on this podcast, I am wrong and Joanna is right. So whenever in the incredibly rare Halley's Comet-esque instance that I'm correct, I always like to just, you know, take a
rub
moment.
It in. Yeah.
Just take it, you know, take it all in.
Feels
and
good.
Then enjoy it before I go back to being corrected by every little thing from Joanna. So.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to say that Pat brought up that it sets a good precedent for the whole Sansa story last week in terms of Margaery was allowed to be married to Joffrey and then again to Tommen because she had not consummated. And I guess there was a scene where they offered to, you know, test Margaery's virtue before she was engaged to Joffrey, the same way that Littlefinger offered up, you know, testing Sansa's virtue. So that's just a little parallel between those two ladies.
There you go. Also, we got a comment about religion, right?
That's another thing that I messed up.
So according to XC commenting at GameofThronesPodcast.com, the faith of the Seven is not polytheistic. The Seven are actually multiple facets of one God, not unlike the Holy Trinity in Christianity. So basically the Seven equals medieval Catholicism and the Sparrows are Lutheran reformists.
Right, and the... You know, Melisandre's religion is not monotheistic either. It's a dual god. It's a two god.
Well, so, John Robinson from Vanity Fair, I'm shocked that you would have gotten the religious tenets of this fictional religion wrong.
Well, okay, two things. I will admit that this is like my biggest weakness in the books. You know, your mileage may vary when it comes to that, but I would say that I zone out the most when they're talking about religion. But I will also acknowledge that they're a hugely important part of the book. So it's not really fair for me to just be like, oh, I don't pay attention. They're not important. They're important. They're very important. I happen to be heathen, so sometimes I zone out a little bit, but this commenter is completely right, and it makes sense if you think about it, especially in light of this episode. We'll talk about that a bit more.
All right. Well, thank you, XC, for explaining the religions of Game of Thrones, and we shall never err on that again. So I'm sure we'll never make any more mistakes again. So let's get to this episode. This is season 5, episode 4, Sons of the Harpy. And before we get into the episode, we should probably mention the opening credit sequence, which we always like to do, right? So this was the first week, I believe, that we got a shot of Dorne in the opening credits, right?
Yes. And God bless every single Cast of Kings listener who sent me a tweet about it, because I got a lot. So thank you. I was thinking of all of you when it happened, and I'm glad that
the explanation is that you were really looking forward to seeing Dorne in the opening
credits. I demanded Dorne be in the opening credits. And
what an opening credit sequence it was. I mean, Dorne looked pretty badass.
Yeah, the snake and the spear and the whole thing. I will say that some of our more, like, pedantic is a harsh word. I don't know. How do I want to describe it? But I know that some people are a little embittered that it says Dorne, because Dorne is the kingdom, and all the other Westeros little landmarks are like the castles, like King's Landing, Winterfell, the Eyrie, Dragonstone. Like, those are the places, not the kingdoms. And so Dorne should technically be like Sunspear, because that's the – but I never for a second thought they would do anything other than Dorne, you know, for it, just because they haven't talked about Sunspear being a castle there. We're having a hard enough time tracking all the new people in Dorne. So that's a little difference that I will admit is different, but I don't think matters.
All right. Well, I didn't even – that whole controversy passed me by completely. So
there you go.
But speaking of controversy, Alan Sepinwall at Hitfix.com did a great interview with I think one of the producers on the show. And he asked them, why doesn't the opening credits match up with what's going on in the episode sometimes, right? And the answer to that question, like, you can go – we'll link to it in the show notes. But the answer is a little bit complicated. Essentially, it boils down to – like, there's certain things that they always want to hit every single episode, right?
Right.
And then also there's this sequence in the opening credits where, like, they go across the narrow sea.
Right.
And they always want to have that regardless of who's in the episode. And because the opening credits are kind of modular but not completely, you can't just mix and match everything, right? Each thing is, like, timed to a specific length. And so so there's all kinds of logistical reasons why they can't show – all the locations that match with everything that's in each episode.
But I believe he said that they always show King's Landing, they always show Winterfell, they always show the Wall, and they always show wherever Dany is to
wherever
get that
Dany is
across the narrow sea
exactly.
thing. Even if Dany is not on the episode.
Correct.
And I liked that about Winterfell. You know, they admitted that they hadn't been at Winterfell, but it was important to have that memory of the Starks in every single opening credit. So I like that.
Yeah, very cool. So we start this episode with, like, right after the last episode ended, immediately picking up with Jorah continuing to kidnap Tyrion. He apparently, like, knocks a dude out and steals his boat, even though he gives him his gold, right?
Yeah.
Like, he rents the boat.
in the most violent way possible.
It's a involuntary rental. I think is how what they're called in Westeros. Let's just talk about this entire plot line.
So I
think there's only a couple scenes, right? It's just this scene, and then midway through the episode, we see Tyrion on the boat with Jorah, like, kind of talking. Like, he convinces Jorah to untie him, and then kind of talks to him about what's going on.
A highborn knight from the north of Westeros, down on his luck in Essos. Dragon epaulets, bear sigil breastplate. Your Jorah Mormont. I have to ask, how exactly were you serving your queen in a whorehouse half a world away? Is it possible that you were running? Why would you be running? And why would she have sent you away? Oh, wait. You were spying on her, weren't you? It's all coming back to me. I was drunk through most of the small council meetings, but it's all coming back. You passed notes to Varys's little birds. She found out, didn't she? Found out and exiled you. Now you hope to win back her favor with a gift. Risky scheme. One might even say desperate. You think Daenerys will execute me and pardon you? I'd say the reverse is just as likely.
What I love about this scene is it reminds you how much of a freaking badass Tyrion is, that he's able to deduce who this person is that has kidnapped him. Go ahead.
Yeah, he did a little like Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock, where he's like, dragon epaulets, bear sigil, you know, like... I can tell from the dirt under your fingernails.
I think you actually meant to say Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock.
Meant to say Basil Rathbone Sherlock, probably.
Okay, well, fair enough.
but I actually found, Tyrion is very smart, and I like that we're reminded of that. I found it a little clunky, though. I felt like he had a lot of exposition put on his shoulders there, and whereas Littlefinger can pull off exposition really well, Peter Dinklage didn't do it quite as well, I thought. Like, the part where he's like, oh, wait, you were spying on her, weren't you? It's all coming back to me. I was just like, I don't know. It just felt like a little much.
Really? So I'm usually the type of person that would complain about stuff like that on this podcast, but I thought it totally worked because it served to remind us about the fact that, you know, 3 years ago, Tyrion was in the Small Council, and we might have forgotten that, and like, kind of his level of involvement with the whole Jorah plotline.
I'm not saying that the exposition wasn't necessary. I'm saying I don't think it was written perfectly, and I don't think Peter Dinklage delivered it as well as he might have.
Interesting. I really like the sequence. I liked it a lot. Right. So,
agree to disagree.
Yeah, and then Jorah kind of decks him, right? That's his punishment.
And Jorah confirms, I think some people are still thinking that Jorah was taking Tyrion to Cersei.
Right, which Jorah, Tyrion thought.
Right. He's like, Westeros is west. That was a good line. But but yeah, so he's taking him to Dany. And even though Tyrion is planning to go to Daenerys anyway, there's a difference going to her as a hostage than going to her on your own accord as like an envoy or something.
Exactly. I believe I pointed that out last week.
Okay.
Sorry. I guess I came up pretty dickish. I'll edit that part out. Exactly, John Robinson. I completely agree. So, what next? Then we cut to the whole sequence with Jaime and Bronn, right? They're heading to Dorne to rescue Marcella, right? Which is – so this is a little bit weird. On the boat – Jaime says, my niece, right? Isn't that what he said?
Yeah.
And then Bronn says, niece? Like, what did you make of that reaction?
He was like, who are we kidding, bro? I know that's your daughter. Don't try to pull that with me. I wasn't born yesterday.
What's nice about this sequence is we get the first real taste of Jaime's reaction to Tyrion killing Tywin.
Yeah.
I don't think it's happened until this episode. Like, we never really knew how he felt about it. Like, maybe he was secretly relieved, you know? Like, we don't know. But this episode, it's pretty clear he is not happy about it.
And it seems pretty extreme to me. And, I mean, I know that Tywin was his father, but he did not get along with Tywin at all. You know, not to say he wanted him dead, but it seems like a very extreme reaction to me. In the books, Tyrion is the one who's mad at Jaime, and Jaime's not mad at Tyrion. So I guess since Tyrion's not mad at Jaime, they needed one of the brothers to be mad at each other. I have no idea why, but they sort of switched their roles here. And it's just a lot more violent than I expected from Jaime to be like, I'm going to cut him in half. Yeah.
I guess, why do you think that it's out of character? You know, like from my perspective, you know, anyone who people can disagree with their parents all the time, but you're going to be pretty unhappy if someone kills them.
I guess I just felt like there was no love lost between Jaime and Tywin, especially in the most recent seasons. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. Although I guess I always felt like there was at the very least a begrudging respect.
Yeah. And, you know, Tywin has earned that for sure. But, of course, if someone kills your father, you should be upset at them. But I don't know. I just felt like there was that goodbye between them was so tender, I thought, when Jaime rescued Tyrion. So it really seemed to show that up until that moment, their bond was pretty tight.
I guess, you know? from my perspective, that goodbye makes Jaime's reaction more understandable because he has set Tyrion free with the implied understanding that Tyrion will not kill their father.
<I guess. laughs> Fair.
And so I guess it kind of feels like a betrayal probably to Jamie, what happened. So
that's a good point.
From my perspective, I think it feels totally within character. So then they arrive at Dorne. Oh, they pass Tarth on the way there, right?
Yeah.
Did this happen in the books?
No. Jamie doesn't even go to Dorne in the books. We've already talked about that.
Yes.
It was like a nice little like, oh, remember when Brienne and Jamie were together? That was fun.
Like, remember when Brienne almost got raped and Jamie told this lie about Tarth to
and Jamie save, lost his hand.
Yeah, and then he lost his hand. All of the memories.
Good time.
Awesome times. So then they arrive at Tarth, and at Dorne. I gotta say, this sequence is incredible. First of all, it looks amazing. Like, it looks like they're actually on a beach, right?
Oh, they were. They did. Yeah. They filmed that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it looks like they had to climb a very long distance to to shoot this scene, and it's awesome. A fight scene breaks out because Jamie predicts, I guess, or Bronn predicts that the captain of the ship has like sold the information to devious people. And he's right, of course.
Well, I think the people that they encounter are just like randomly out there.
I got
it. Because we see the captain stuff later.
Right. So the people showing up is not a direct result of that captain's foolishness.
Right.
So then they have a pretty awesome fight scene where the two of them kill four people on horseback. Which is really impressive. And
Jamie is one-handed. And the whole one-handed fight choreography was really interesting to me.
Well, I kept anticipating them, like him using the one-handed thing in some way, and he finally does. And so it was very satisfying when they picked that up. This is the first time we've seen him fight since only having one hand.
Right. We've seen him spar, but this is the first like real combat.
Yeah, where there's like it's like life or death situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So really impressive fight scene, and you get the feeling like, hey, these guys are like in a good, they might not succeed, but they at least have a fighting chance at succeeding in their mission. So any other thoughts about this sequence, Joan Robinson?
Yeah, I pointed this out on Twitter today, but if you rewatch this episode, or I don't know if they'll be wearing these outfits next week, but please note that Jamie and Bronn are wearing matching jackets. And I just like hope that, you know, Jamie showed up in his cool leather jacket when he went to go pick up Bronn, and Bronn's like, yeah, I'll go with you, but first I have to get a matching one made so that we can be matching jacket bros on our adventure.
Of course. And why wouldn't you?
I mean, come on.
It only makes sense. So there's also...
I also do want to mention that they had that conversation before the fight about, you know, how do you want to die? And Jamie says this thing about, you know, I want to die in the arms of the woman I love. And Bronn's like, does she feel the same way? Basically, you know, accurately summing up Cersei. So I don't know. I like this little relation. I always love Bronn when he's with one of the Lannister boys. So
yeah, it's great. Although Bronn said, you know, he's had too much adventure and he wants to die peacefully. That to me is a red flag warning that this character will die horribly, I guess.
But that's how you conclude most things. You're like, well, this being Game of Thrones, they're probably going to die horribly.
I know.
Which is accurate.
It's true. But am I wrong for thinking that of most characters? I mean, many characters have met with horrible ends in the show, right?
Right. Yes.
And it's not like I'm indiscriminately going around predicting that, Jonah Robinson. I mean, I'm taking cues from the show to help me out.
So
we'll see what happens with Bronn and his mission here. We should point out that there's another scene in Dorne that happens. What's her name? Ilaria, right? Or
yeah, Ilaria.
One of them is her daughter, right? Or are they all her daughters?
Let me give you a little sand snake primer.
Yes.
So these are the sand snakes who Ilaria mentioned earlier in the season when she was talking to Prince Doran. She's like, you know, I have the sand snakes on my side. So they are – the sand snakes is the name of the bastard daughters of Oberyn Martell, of which there are many in the books and maybe only three in the show. Obara is the oldest. She's played by Keisha Castle Hughes. She's probably the only actress you might recognize from Whale Rider, etc. Then there's Nymeria and Tyene. And Tyene is the one who's actually Ilaria's daughter. And they all have their various weapons – Obara with her spear, Tyene with her knives and Nymeria with her whip, I believe. And yeah, so this is the introduction to these great Dornish characters. I didn't love it. I have to say, I did not love this scene as much as I love these characters. So I'm hoping that the Sand Snake stuff improves.
It felt very, very abridged. I mean, we get very little information about these characters. And I was listening to the – or watching the Inside the Episode thing after. And, you know, Benioff and Weiss were talking about these characters' motivations and their relationship to Laria and Oberyn. And I was like, I did not get any of
this. No. No, what you got was two names, because I don't think they even say Tyene's name. You get two names and you get the weapons. And, like, that's as – and vengeance, and that's as much character development as you get.
Yeah.
Obara's speech, the one that Keisha Castle Hughes does, is, like, verbatim from the books. But it just did not translate very well to the screen, I thought. And yeah, this is not how – they're introduced sort of one by one in the books over time, because they have more time and more luxury, and that's fine. But the way they abridged it, for me, this felt really stiff. But I am optimistic, or hopeful, I guess, that it'll get better.
Yeah, it felt really rushed and not particularly interesting. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens with the rest of the show.
And they're just like under a tarp in the middle of the sand. So
that is their entire home base, is a simple tarp with a few weapons. Somehow they're able to bury this guy up to his neck. I don't know how, but they did.
They're resourceful and scrappy.
So on the one hand, I don't feel bad for that guy. But on the other hand, is there no honor in Dorne for people who just want to sell information?
Yeah, I don't get it. Like, he was like, hey, Obara, you're going to want this info. She's like, cool, we're going to bury you. Put a bucket on your head.
We're going to throw a spear through your face?
Yeah.
That's your reward for – that's a really bad way of encouraging people to give you valuable information, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyone who gives you valuable information that they shouldn't be giving you but that you want ends up horribly dead, like, or you know, maimed in some way.
But yeah, I like the Sand Snakes, and I would like to see for both of them and Ilaria a different speed than like hot-blooded vengeance, which I feel like is all we've seen so far.
Right.
So, some nuance.
I don't know. I'm okay with it. I mean, you know, there's some – for some reason what comes to mind is 6 Feet Under.
Uh-huh.
You watch that show. I haven't finished the end of that show yet, but I still remember when a major character died in one season, and like there was well, I guess it doesn't narrow it down. But there's one character who is like stricken with grief and became incredibly self-destructive. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
And there's just this kind of like primal rage and self, you know, you just want to, the bottom just falls out of your life and you just, you know, want to do anything you can to destroy something beautiful. That's kind of how it feels with Ilaria. You know, it's like I totally buy that she was in love with Oberyn, and they built that up really well last season. Basically, I'm defending this episode from you. This, you know,
we're gonna get to things podcast. I like. I'm being a little negative so far.
It's usually the other way around. So very curious. Anyway, John Robinson, I got a question for you.
What's that?
What is Daenerys Targaryen's favorite Squarespace feature? The drag and drop templates.
Boom!
Boom goes the dynamite. That joke comes in from Bob B. But you know what? He's got a point. Squarespace is an awesome way to create your own website, blog, or online store. And if drag and drop templates, drag and drop templates,
I get it,
are Daenerys's Targaryen's favorite feature, then it's because Daenerys Targaryen, she knows how to make a website really quickly and easily. And you can do it by using Squarespace's drag and drop templates. This site is simple, powerful, and beautiful. 24/7 support via live chat and email is what they offer you for only $8 a month. And if you use promo code CASTOFKINGS, you get 10% off at checkout. Do you have any more Squarespace jokes? Can you beat what Bob B wrote into us? If so, write into us at acastofkings@gmail.com. I think we have a lot of punny listeners.
Oh my God, the like the groanier the pun, the better, please.
Yes, we love it. We love it. But in any case, going back to Squarespace, oftentimes it is really challenging to set up a website. I mean, Jonah Robinson, have you ever attempted it before in your life?
I have. It's it, I am not well suited for
it. And you sucked ass at it, if I recall correctly.
I did.
Well, fortunately, Squarespace offers a really easy way to create those websites. I'm terrible, too. I don't know any HTML. I can barely string sentences together, both in on text and also in audio. So for me, Squarespace is a huge benefit. It lets me set up a beautiful website really quickly. I have a movie coming out in the near future that I directed called The Primary Instinct, which is premiering at the Seattle International Film Festival this year. And I plan to use that Squarespace to set up the website for that project because it is incredibly easy to use and can make you something really good looking in a very short period of time. So, you like how I got in two plugs in there simultaneously, John Robinson?
That was next level.
Next level plugging, guys. Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, just use offer code CASTOFKINGS to get 10% off your first purchase. And also, I should point out that while it's only $8 a month, you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for a year. So, check it out, squarespace.com. Use promo code Cast of Kings. We hope you guys will use that promo code and support Squarespace because they support Cast of Kings. In addition to Squarespace, a lot of other people also supported us. And they are our Kickstarter backers. And these are people who felt so strongly that a Cast of Kings should return that they kicked in a little bit of money for us via Kickstarter. So we got to thank these people and apologies in advance for butchering their names. Firstly, Eva Chung. Got to thank her. You know, there's a huge mystery we seeded back a few episodes. I said so-and-so is my second favorite listener.
Yeah.
Well, Eva Chung, first favorite listener right there.
Number
so
one.
That's, the mystery is now solved.
First of her name.
Laws Aggleton, which again is like another name I feel like.
No, he's donated for years. We know him.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that person has donated for years. I'm just saying that as a name, you know, I don't know.
Although I don't know if everyone saw this because I put it on Twitter, but we got photographic proof from the person that whose existence Dave challenged last week. So
what's his name again? His Fox Mulder-esque name?
Tapio something, I think.
Let's find that by the end of this segment.
Okay.
Yeah. Who else do we got to thank? Jonathan Carpenter, Stephen Hewitt, Stephen Greer, Ron Harshman, Eric Goodkin, Carol Lee, Derek Peterson, Lynn Catroni?
Citroni? Yeah.
Brand Smith, the Movie Bears Podcast, and James Adams the Third. What a cool name. James Adams the Third. So regal sounding.
I also think the name from last week, which is Tapio Leopold, was also regal sounding.
It's pretty regal. You know, like just with if you're an Asian person, it's hard to have a name like James Adams the Third. Chen the Third just doesn't have the same ring to it. So cherish that name, James Adam the Third. Cherish that name.
All right. So I want to thank Brian Parry, Leah Roque, Rabid Puffin, Annette Passier-Bisky, Christopher Fonseca, Rowan and Jen from Queensland, Australia, Mark Duckers, Jonathan Yonatan, Eric Sandstrom, Bastian Bach, Khalil D, Laura, best wife in the world, Zimmerman, and Charlotte, I love you, David Chen, McConnell.
Nice. Wow, what a crazy middle name that is.
I wonder what
Charlotte's parents were thinking when they gave her that. Very curious. All right, let's get back to the show. So what else is going on in this episode? Let's talk about what happens at the wall this episode.
Okay.
So this episode we see Melisandre try to convince John to go join them, right?
Yeah. Because he knows all the secret passageways of Winterfell.
Yes.
So
exactly. Why do you say that as though you don't believe that that's the case?
No, I do. I just like that it's so transparent. I don't know. We need you because you know the secret doors.
So then Melisandre tries to seduce John.
Yeah.
And So what did you think of this section, Jenna Robinson?
I rolled my eyes pretty hard.
Oh, really? Why is that?
You know, it was just like, let's get the Carice Van Houten nudity in as early and often as possible. I don't know, but it was good character development for Jon Snow, I thought, to see him turn her down, to see him be loyal to Ygritte, to see him really, I feel like, be tempted by how he would have behaved when he was younger and stick to his vow. I thought was good. What did you think?
I got to say, like, okay, we complain a lot about nudity on the show, right? And about how, like, unequal it is. But I got to say, dude, this scene was pretty hot. I mean, did you not think it was hot?
Yeah, it was hot.
I don't know. I guess I thought it was, like, most of the nudity on the show I don't find particularly titillating, simply because it feels so excessive and not really, like, it's there, like, as, like, almost like wall decoration, like, oh, we're doing this because we can, and not used for any, like, particular purpose, it feels. Mm-hmm. And this actually felt like it served a plot purpose and gave John a nice character moment. And yeah, I mean, she's also a very attractive woman. So
she's very beautiful.
Yeah.
And she's a cool lady. She did an interview with one of my colleagues at Vanity Fair this week. That video is up on the site. Cool lady. But yeah, she does have a fondness for bastards, I guess. The last bastard we saw her try to seduce was Gendry. And speaking of that, we skipped over sort of the part where Selyse and Stannis are in the courtyard watching Jon fight. And Selyse reminded me so much of Catelyn in that moment because she was talking about Jon's bastardy. And, you know, Stannis is kind of defending him and defending Ned Stark, which I just thought was – I liked that character moment for both of them. Because we hate Selyse. Anyone who hates Jon is, like, kind of hard to love. She hates Jon for no reason. She hates her own daughter. She's the worst. So.
Right. She's not the greatest character.
No.
Yeah, and the only other thing I wanted to point out that occurred to me while watching this scene is that that is some really good acting by Carice Van Houten, because, like, when she's placing John's hands on her parts, she is doing it, like, completely nonchalantly, you know what I mean? Like, as though, like, this is something that she does all the time. And that is difficult to pull off. Like, it's just difficult to act that way. And it's, you know, you're, like, exposed. There's people, like, filming you. So anyway, I thought it was a good job on her part.
And we should note before she came in, Sam was having John send for recruits from the Northern Lords, including Roose Bolton.
Right, which John refused to do, right?
Did he sign it in the end?
I feel like they were interrupted. That's my recollection, but maybe, I don't know.
Dear listeners, please write in. I think he signed it in the end. I think he sort of resigned himself to his duty to the wall versus his Starkish vengeance. But let me know what you think.
Yeah. So then we get this nice scene with Stannis and his daughter.
Oh, God. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. You're like, oh, I heard you saying on your breath, oh, God, like, oh, God, that was terrible, or oh, God, wow, it was very moving.
I have watched that scene like 5 times now, and I have cried every single time. So I promised that I would talk about things I love in this episode. This Stannis scene, oh, it went so far towards making that character who has been so stiff and so dour someone that we really want to root for, right?
Yeah. I mean, you really get a sense of his humanity after this.
Yeah.
You get a sense of, like, the good elements, because he has had very little to redeem him up until this point.
No, I mean, Stannis isn't a bad guy, right? Like, he's honor bound, but he's not dastardly like most of the people.
Well, he's
in
just like an unpleasant person.
But yeah,
he's off putting. There's no particular reason why you'd think, oh, this would make a good king.
He has his supporters, so you watch out. You might anger the Stannis supporters. But I never trust a person who has like one friend. And he has one friend, and he cut off his fingers.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, so you agree with me then? Like, you agree that he's not exactly like the person we would choose to be king of the Seven Kingdoms?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, the dichotomy they set up is that Renly is the popular brother, right? And Stannis was the actual, probably better ruler mm-hmm. of the two. Yeah, you want your politicians, you want your leaders to have charisma. But that doesn't mean that the person who is not great at peopling would be a terrible ruler, you know? Renly and Stannis together would be the perfect team. You know, but I think that Stannis does have something that's important and honorable and worth supporting. But it really, really helps to see, you know, it's basically like a politician going out and kissing babies. Like when he's talking to his daughter, his poor grayscale afflicted daughter, and hugging her.
Or not hugging her, as it were.
Well, no, and then he did.
No, I know he did, but it took him a second.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they did that to show that he's not particularly physically affectionate, even though he has a soft side.
I believe there was a scene before, and I'm just going off an image I saw, so I didn't rewatch the scene, but I think there's a scene from either season 2 or 3 where Shireen tries to hug him, and it goes even
worse,
more poorly than this. Yeah. So this is progress for Stannis.
Definitely, yeah. It was a very nice scene, and it really does do a lot for that character, because, yeah, you rarely get to see him in this state, so.
I was told you would die, or worse, the grayscale would go slow. Let you grow just enough to know the world before taking it away from you. Everyone advised me to send you to the ruins of Valyria to live out your short life with the stone men before the sickness spread through the castle. I told them all to go to hell. I called in every maester on this side of the world, every healer, every apothecary. They stopped the disease and saved your life. Because you did not belong across the world with a bloody stone man. You were the Princess Shireen of House Baratheon. And you are my daughter.
Does the grayscale stuff make sense to you?
A little bit. I mean, I think the idea is that this is a disease that people aren't super clear on what it is. And, like, it's often fatal to people, and that her survival is improbable.
Yeah.
Right, that's what I got from it. And also, it might be contagious. That's the thing that I wasn't sure about.
Yeah, it's infectious, but not everyone gets it. So she got it from this doll. But, you know, just because you're near someone who has grayscale doesn't mean you're going to get it, but you don't know. You can't know.
Right.
So, yeah. And Gilly talked about it before, so.
Yeah, they talked about it a couple episodes ago, if
yep.
I recall. Yeah.
All right. Then it can get way worse. Then Shireen got off pretty light, basically.
Right. For sure. Okay. Anything else going on at the wall that we want to mention? Or I think that covers it, right?
I think so.
All yeah. right. So.
I mean, no Ollie this week, so I'm sure you were pretty bummed.
I was crushed.
You're devastated.
I was beside myself. So, anyway. Didn't they mention Ollie? I feel like they mentioned him. But he, I don't know.
Maybe that was just your heart crying out, I think.
I seriously feel like he was mentioned, but maybe that I just imagined it. All right, so a couple of other plot lines we got to mention. There is the King's Landing and then what goes on at Winterfell, right?
Yeah.
Which one would you like to cover first, John Robinson from Vanity Fair?
I think we should end with Winterfell, so let's go to King's Landing.
All right, so in King's Landing.
Oh, and Meereen, right?
That's right. That's right. Oh, yeah. Of course. I think we should end with Meereen.
Yeah, we should definitely end with Meereen. Okay.
So King's Landing. Bunch of stuff happens. So we saw last week that you know, Cersei's allying herself with the High Sparrow. And this week she kind of makes that official and gives him an army or gives him access to soldiers. Is that correct?
You and I both know how the world works. Too often the wicked are the wealthiest, beyond the reach of justice. The king himself cannot always punish those who deserve it most.
All sinners are equal before the gods.
What would you say if I told you of a great sinner in our very midst, shielded by gold and privilege?
May the Father judge him justly.
So she arms the sparrows, basically.
Gotcha.
And resurrects an old group called the Faith Militant. So she not only arms them, but she gives them free reign to do whatever they want to clean up the city.
Right.
You can tell the Faith Militant by that very charming brand that they have on their foreheads. And we see Lancel Lannister become one. We see them raid the brothels and that sort of stuff. I really did love, before we get to that though, I really did love the scene between Jonathan Pryce and Lyanna Headey. And she makes him the High Septon. And it's really interesting because I feel like Cersei thinks she's really clever in this scene.
Correct. Correct. I guess my question is, like, does Cersei believe in the High Sparrow's cause as a point of fact? Or is she only doing it so that she can get Loras Tyrell? And that is the full extent of her game here. Because if it is the full extent of her game, then I feel as though this whole High Sparrow situation is going to have consequences that she's not prepared for.
So the best, comparison, not best. I think I tried to make this comparison last week and backed off of it, but it might have been on the Storm of Spoilers podcast that I do, but trying to compare Cersei to Gamergate. Okay, so I read this really long piece about the guy who basically kicked off Gamergate.
Yeah, this is in Boston Magazine, I think.
Boston Magazine, yeah, exactly. And there's that great part where they talk about how he, throughout this whole shitstorm that he started, he would post things like, hey guys, don't do this. It doesn't really help the cause. I don't think you should do this. And was sort of working behind scenes to actually stoke the flames of it. And that's when, you know, having read that this week, it was really at the forefront of my mind thinking about Cersei and her talking to Tommen and being like, oh, I didn't do this. I had nothing to do with it. Oh, it's them and I have no control over them. I think Cersei has no faith, no right. belief in what the sparrows have to do other than to see them as a tool to wage war with the Tyrells without getting her hands dirty.
Right. And I guess my prediction, which is not exactly earth-shattering, is that it will have unintended consequences. I mean, you can't do what she did in this episode and, you know, things not go badly after that in some unforeseen way, I feel.
The other thing I wanted to point out really quickly is you asked last week what Cersei sent to Littlefinger. Correct. Like, what was the message she sent to him? And we saw when she was talking to the High Sparrow, we saw on her desk was his response, because it had like his little finger, his little mockingbird sigil on it. And so she already had his response when she was talking to him. And so my belief, you know, I said last week that I thought I knew what it was. My belief is that Cersei asked Littlefinger for dirt on the Tyrells. And he said, hey, did you know Loras is super duper gay? Is his response. That's my belief. That's not based on book knowledge. That's just based on, you know, how I think this is all happening.
Well, I guess what is confusing to me about what you just said is that in this episode, Littlefinger indicates that he's going back to King's Landing.
Uh-huh.
Right? And that this is at the behest of Cersei.
Yeah.
So are you saying that in addition to her calling for him, he also dished the dirt on Loras?
I think so. Yeah.
So it was like a multi-purpose message then?
I think so. I could be wrong. Maybe she called him back for another purpose. But like just, I don't know, how much his brothel is involved. You know, I feel like she asked him specifically for dirt. And he's like, here's my dirt. She's like, give me dirt and come back. I need your help.
But then, I don't know. I guess I just don't buy that. Because if that was the case, why would she completely like ruin his brothel first? You know, like, she's got to think he's going to be pretty pissed when he gets back. You know?
I don't think so, because he's like lord of the area now. He doesn't really need his brothel anymore. Hmm. So
okay,
but I don't know. That's just guessing.
All right. So this sets off. So they get Loras, and this sets off a chain reaction of events where Tommen tries to.
Oh yeah, I really want to say sorry. I keep interrupting you, but first of all, it's not really fair to have Lancel and Loras in the same goddamn scene because they always mix up their names. So to have them like talk to each other, that's dirty.
Have one of them arrest the other one, essentially.
Secondly, and we're going to talk about this a little bit when we get to Barriss and Selmy, but this just sort of speaks to how much the show has changed the character of Loras. Loras is like the best knight in King's Landing. And we sort of got that at the very beginning of the first season, but ever since he's just sort of been Marjorie's gay brother, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like you don't think of Loras as this great, amazing fighter because they just haven't been reiterating that. So the fact that he was just arrested without putting up any kind of fight is surprising to me. I feel like the Loras of the books would have fought that arrest.
You know, I thought about that as well, actually, John Robinson, despite not having that context. And I actually thought the way that the arrest scene was executed was fairly convincing. I mean, like, I was thinking to myself, man, Loras is going to fight these guys off. But there's, like, 30 guys, you know, and he is not anticipating, you know, them arriving and arresting them at all. Because why would he even anticipate? Why would he think that's even a possibility?
Right? He was, like, practicing. He was fighting. I mean, I think they had wooden practice swords. But
right.
I still feel like Loras would have gone down swinging.
Hmm.
It would have tried. And book Loras would have won is my opinion. Like, that's
think,
how amazing.
I mean, I don't think he went quietly into the night. It just, he wasn't in a situation that he could have defended himself, in my opinion. So
yeah,
Once again, I find this episode more plausible than you. But that's cool. That's cool. So Tommen goes and tries to get an audience with the High Septon. And they say, hey, you can't talk to him. He's praying right now. And it is a very uncomfortable scene.
Yeah, the crowd turns on him and calls him bastard.
Oh, actually, we should also point out before this scene, Margaery talks to Tommen and, you know, explains to him, hey, your mom imprisoned my brother. And he's like, but I thought you and mom got along swimmingly.
Oh, my God. That was like one of my favorite lines of the episode. He was like, aren't you and mother getting along? And she had to shift gears
yeah,
so
she's like,
hard.
Oh, my gosh. Wait a second. Yeah, you
she's
still
like,
think
slam
that.
She's like, slam on the brakes.
Yep. She's like, okay, take a deep breath, Margaery. Yeah. And let's continue with the fiction that we were in. Yeah. So pretty great. Pretty great stuff.
Well, and then Cersei sent him into a situation she knew he could not handle.
Right.
Which was just some shitty mothering. And but I do like that it all ended with Margaery basically saying she's going to call in Lady Olenna, which I think we're all excited for that possibility. So
yeah. So yeah, that scene, like, I felt really bad for Tom in this episode because
I know me too,
because he is so clearly unequipped to handle the task that is put before him.
Poor little lamb.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
He's in a bad way right now.
Yeah.
A few other things I want to point out about this sequence. One of them is that, like, from my perspective, the people shouting at him and calling him a bastard, you know, that's pretty bad. That's not good. But it was the fact that he couldn't get what he wanted with the High Sparrow that I thought felt like a significant violation of his sovereignty or whatever you want to call it, right?
Well, the bastard thing is significant because I feel like this wasn't something that people there was gossip and whispers that, you know, Joffrey and Tommen were born of incest, but for his subjects to shout at the king, you are a bastard. Like, that is so brazen. They're so emboldened by the Faith Militant.
They are in Faith Militant territory. But yes,
right.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. Like, that's not cool for you to shout, you know, terrible things at the king and accuse him of things.
Well, it's not just that. It's that, I don't know, it just seems transgressive. It's like, oh my God, you're going to talk about the incest thing out in the open? Like, Bronn at least had the decency to just sort of cock an eyebrow at Jaime.
Just like imply it, heavily infer things.
Nice, really, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But yeah, for me, it was the way that he got turned away that I was just like, wow, like if you say no to the king, like that is, you understand the power dynamic really quickly when that happens, right?
Right.
And the only solution in that situation is violence. If you're the king, and you, like we just had this conversation last week about like if you need to show your power, like with Jon Snow, right? He needed to show his power. He cut a dude's head off, and that's really what Tommen needed to do to hold on to power in this situation.
Joffrey would have had all of those sparrows killed, like on the spot.
Like he wouldn't have even given them the opportunity to show them to the High Sparrow.
Right?
Like he would have just done it. Out of principle, right off the bat.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, we never thought.
Say we missed Joffrey's antics. But here we are, John Robinson from Vanity Fair. So. All right. So then, there's a great scene where Margaery kind of chews him out.
Yeah.
And she walks away from him and, he says, like, is there anything I can do? And there's a shot that lingers on her face where she's facing the camera.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm sorry. And, I just must be with my family right now.
Yeah.
And what did you make of that shot? Like, why do you think they chose to shoot it that way? Why do you think the director of this episode, Mark Mylod or Milod, chose to shoot it that way?
I think it just gave Natalie Dormer the opportunity to let five things play across her face to let her, do the math on her situation
where
she thought she was in control of the king and she had things handled. And now she realized that the king, her tool, is completely ineffectual and she needs to bring in the big guns, which would, according to this episode, be her grandmother. So
I think that is a great interpretation and most likely correct. I will say that the first thing that occurred to me is just that all the fakeness and calculation was gone from her.
Yeah.
And that what you're seeing was just like raw Margaery. Like that, she is genuinely in distress in that scene, right? Like, she doesn't feel like she has any control of the situation. Like, it's just bad for her and her family, and like, she's honestly fears for her brother's life. And that's what I thought was registering on her face.
I think that's also very true.
It's like unadulterated, you know, in like last episode and even parts of this episode where you get glimpses of her face when Tommen can't see her face. Right. And you kind of see the calculation and like what's going on. And this scene, it just shows you, hey, this is all genuine. There's nothing, there's no more calculation here. She needs to get herself out of this situation. So I thought that was great. What else? So I think the final plot line is Meereen, right? Is that the only other thing that's left?
No, Winterfell.
Winterfell. That's right. Okay, yeah, sorry. So one thing I wanted to bring up about Winterfell is this is an instance, Gianna Robinson from Vanity Fair, where the previously on flashback sequence or whatever, the previously on sequence at the beginning of the episode that HBO shows was actually a great benefit to the viewer. Because it shows like Robert Baratheon placing this feather on the statue of Lyanna.
Yeah.
And I totally would not have remembered that if it were not for the previously on scene. And it didn't really spoil anything. It's not like, oh, we're going to see that feather again. You know what I mean? Like, that's not the first thought that occurs to you. And even if it is, it's not like it spoils a major plot point. So I actually thought the previously
on scene. For one time,
it was actually a huge benefit.
Good.
So Sansa is in the crypts of Winterfell, paying tribute to the dead. And there's a lot of stuff to unpack in this sequence. What did you think of this exchange between her and Littlefinger?
I will say for the first part, okay, so the Shireen scene made me cry a bunch of times. And then this is a moment that I've been waiting for a really long time. This is a backstory that I love, the tourney of Harrenhal. It's one of the stories, one of the ways it's told in the book is actually, Jojen and Mira Reed tell it to Bran way back. It's called The Night of the Laughing Tree. And it's this beautiful story that they tell, all in allegory, where they call her like, I don't know, something like they call her like the wolf princess. You know, like they don't use names. They just use it's really beautiful. This was a more straightforward telling, but it still made me really happy to hear about Rhaegar, Lyanna, Ilya. The Mad King, Barriss and Selmy, like this is all the backstory in the books that the show usually doesn't have time for.
Right.
So I'm really glad that they made time for this. Rhaegar gets brought up twice in this episode. I really loved that part. And then this, the Littlefinger's plan part is a little more confusing to me, but
Hold on. Before we move on, so can you explain the broad strokes of this Rhaegar Targaryen plotline? Essentially, Rhaegar Targaryen is Dany's brother, right?
Right.
And he is the crown prince, so he's next in line to the throne. To who is on the throne at this point in the story?
Like Mad King Aerys.
Mad King who?
Aerys.
Aerys, who Jaime Lannister kills, and then.
Right.
Robert Baratheon replaces. Is that
right.
correct?
And okay. the reason this tourney is so important is what happened is, so Rhaegar is married to Ilya Martell, who's Oberyn's brother, right? So mm-hmm. Rhaegar's the crown prince. He's married to Ilya. They have kids. And that's the whole, like, you know, you raped her, you murdered her, you killed her children. Like, that's Ilya Martell. She was going to be the queen, sit next to the Iron Throne. But at the tourney of Harrenhal, when Rhaegar won, he took his favor, which was a crown of roses, and he should have given them to his wife.
Who is again?
Ilya Martell.
Ilya Martell, right.
But he rode right past her and set a crown of roses at the feet of Lyanna Stark, which is like, damn, what? And then later, the way that – there's just a million different ways the story is told, but the way that Sansa heard it is that he abducted Lyanna and raped her against her will. And then there are other stories that actually they were in love and they eloped. So the truth is not entirely clear. But this is what kicked off what's called Robert's Rebellion. So Robert Baratheon was engaged to Lyanna. So when Rhaegar like absconds with Lyanna, Robert and Ned are like, no, you do not take my betrothed and my sister. And they start Robert's Rebellion, which is what led to the Targaryens being taken down.
Gotcha.
So this is the inciting incident for why Robert Baratheon, why Dany is across the Narrow Sea, why Robert Baratheon was on the throne, all this sort of stuff. So,
meaning the kidnapping or Rhaegar fancying Lyanna?
The kidnapping, but the tourney of Harrenhal is like the first, yeah, inciting incident, I guess.
So let's talk about the other Rhaegar story later on.
Yeah. But so that's why Robert Baratheon was in the crypts in the very first episode of Game of Thrones, is he came down because he was in love with Lyanna. It's why Cersei is so pissed off, because she knows that Robert loved Lyanna and never loved her. You know, and so he loved Lyanna. So he puts that feather on her tomb, because she was the love of his life.
So. Right. So anyway, there's a lot of conversation that goes on between Sansa and Littlefinger here, and it sounds like you were not sure how to feel about it.
Well, okay, so my question still stands from last week, which is that I don't know whether or not Littlefinger knows what a psychopath Ramsay is.
Right.
He could and be lying to Sansa by saying you can handle Ramsay, no problem.
Yep.
Or this could be a rare, weird incident where Littlefinger doesn't know what's going on. I really honestly don't know. But if Littlefinger doesn't know that Ramsay is a psychopath, then that's, you know, that's a shame, because usually he's smarter than that with his schemes. If he does know that Ramsay is a psychopath and he's leaving Sansa with him, then Littlefinger is
even worse than we thought he was, and he was already pretty bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But he does.
But then he also has this weird, like, oblique plan where he's like, you know, I think Stannis, you know, he's Team Stannis now too. He must have watched that scene with Shireen. But like, he's like, I think Stannis is going to beat the Boltons, and you know, we want to be in a position where we can either take advantage of the Boltons or take advantage of Stannis when he gets here and position you to become the wardeness of the North. That's why I want you here. But I don't know why she needs to be there in the clutches of the Boltons for that to happen. Like, right. If he really believes that Stannis is going to win, why wouldn't they just, like, wait in the area for that to happen?
It seems like a huge risk. He's like, yeah, they'll either come and, like, wage this huge war against Winterfell, and they'll either win or lose. Either way, you're going to be okay. And it's like, really?
Yeah, really?
I don't know how much I, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, people die at weddings all the time, let alone wars. You know, let alone massive battles.
Yeah.
So it is a bit weird. I mean, and it sounds like it's all show invention, right? So
yeah, exactly. So I don't really understand. I'm sure it'll all become clear. Whether or not it will still have the holes in it, we'll see. But, you know, I'm sure we don't know every single step of Littlefinger's plan yet, because right. He works in mysterious ways.
It's also not 100% clear. I know we mentioned this earlier. Not 100% clear, like, why Cersei is calling Littlefinger back, right? Like, we don't know exactly. Does he explain it? I forget.
No, you know, like I said, I think it's to help her with her little war she's waging on the Tyrells, but we will see if that bears out.
Is this also not in the books, this whole?
Also not in the books.
Wow. All right. So, and you haven't seen any future episodes, right?
And I have not seen any future episodes.
You can't even lord over future show knowledge over me anymore.
Like, most of this episode is not in the books, to be perfectly honest with you. So,
well, we are in this. The whole dynamic of Cast of Kings is going to be completely shot to hell, because
it's getting shaky.
It's mostly about Joanna Robinson explaining things to me, and that's not going to happen.
I still can explain some things.
All right, all right.
Some things.
Fair enough. Yeah, the whole Rhaegar thing, for instance. Okay. Anyway, let's talk about the last plot line, which happens in Meereen, which is
One last thing I wanted to say between the parallel between the last – well, it's not the last time we were in the crypt in Winterfell, but sort of the most important time we were in the crypt in Winterfell, season one, episode one. When Robert and Ned are down there, they're in the crypt, and that's when Robert asks Ned to be the Hand of the King. And he also says, I have a son. You have a daughter. Let's join our houses. So basically that's where Robert proposes that Sansa marry Joffrey. And so I kind of like this flip where, you know, then she wasn't even part of the conversation. She was just this little pawn in this political marriage. And here, you know, you could argue that she's still sort of in a pawn position, but she's at least part of this current plan, right. You know?
It shows how much she's evolved. And in the inside the episode, they were talking about how, like, when she left Winterfell, she was so naive about, oh, you know, princes and castles and kings, and everything's going to be awesome, and I want to go to King's Landing and all this stuff. And not only has she grown up a lot, but she's also grown to appreciate Winterfell and her home, you know, in a way that she didn't, because she wanted, all she wanted to do was get away from it in the past.
Right.
And now she has like a newfound appreciation for it. And you definitely see that in the performance, I feel, when she's like lighting the candles and stuff. So, all right. So last sequence here that happens in Meereen. And one thing I wanted to mention is, for the most part, with a few exceptions, but for the most part, like, this episode plays out in such a way that rather than jumping around from place to place, it feels like each plot line plays itself out within each location before moving on to the next plot line.
Yeah, which is unusual. Usually it shuffles around. So
I actually like it this way. You know, I feel like it's less disjointed. I feel like it feels more satisfying to me. Do you have any opinion on it?
Yeah, I liked that aspect, the plotting of this episode. I did enjoy before. It made some like connective themes more obvious before, right, when you would cut back and forth between plot lines. But I think you can still draw parallels in an interesting way, this format.
Definitely. So in this scene in Meereen, Barristan Selmy like tells a story about Rhaegar.
Yeah. Right?
And it's quite different from the story that that was told earlier. According to listener Chris, he writes in, I have a question about the two reputations. When Littlefinger and Sansa were having their way, their very gross moment, Rhaegar was seen as an inconsiderate brute, one who kidnaps and rapes and throws all caution to the wind and starts terrible wars. However, when Barristan Selmy talks about him, he's kind, charitable, and has a lovely singing voice. Are we to believe that Rhaegar was capable of the terrible things that Sansa believes he did? Or is this another case of propaganda taking hold, like when Daenerys is informed of who the Mad King really was?
Honestly, I'm just going to go on show information right here and say that I believe that Littlefinger shoots Sansa a very significant look when she says he abducted and raped my aunt, Lyanna. I think that if you look at Littlefinger, you see an expression on his face that says, oh, did he? I don't think – this is not concrete in the books, but I think it's clear that we don't know everything that happened with Rhaegar, you know?
Right.
So –
So it's interesting how the show plays with that notion of truth and the stories, yeah, that we tell each other. And there's actually a line earlier this episode when Jaime says, like, he doesn't care what songs are sung about him when he's dead. And so it's kind of interesting, like, how people have this mythology and how that mythology is played around with and sort of twisted depending on which character you're talking to.
Yeah, and Jamie, when we met him at this whole mythology, I mean, he was, you know, the golden boy of the court, you know, and nobody then knew that he was boning his sister, you know, like, yeah, the idea of reputation and legend is played up a lot. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, Chris's email refers to the gross moment between Sansa and Littlefinger. What'd you make of that? Did you think that was gross?
Oh, super gross. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It was weird. Kissing on the mouth is weird, unless it's like romantic, you know?
Just feels she's like Stannis approaching a hug from his daughter. She's like, oh, this is happening. Okay, it's happening. Like, Sansa's never into it. Littlefinger, it's like a possessive thing, but he also doesn't seem like he's not a man. I don't think he's a man in love, but I think, yeah, he's a man like, exactly, wanting, this is his possession, you know?
Right. It's weird and unsettling.
Yep. So.
All right. So, you know, Barristan Selmy tells her the story, and then Sons of the Harpy come out. And then, you know, this same dude petitions her to, like, hey, please open the fighting pits.
His star. Yeah.
And as he's talking about it, we see shots of Sons of the Harpy like going in and just killing everyone, and then they set up what appears to be an ambush for the Unsullied, and then Barristan Selmy joins in, and then it's, to me, vague as to whether or not Grey Worm and Barristan Selmy survive. It's most likely they die, but you just never know with TV. It just, like, you just don't know. Like, unless it's definitively the dead, you just don't know.
Well, yeah, I'm reminded of season one when Bran goes out the window, and I think most people thought Bran was dead because he got pushed out a window, which is not a bad assumption to make.
A lot of people still think Bran is dead.
A lot of people wish Bran had died. Okay, yeah.
But yeah, you just don't know. And I mean, there's been plenty of instances in TV. I think of, like, the first episode of NYPD Blue for some reason, where Sipowicz was shot like 18 times or something ridiculous like that. And then he ended up being like the main character of the whole show. So anyway, you just don't know. So we'll find out.
You don't know when an NYPD Blue reference is going to come in handy. That's
right.
For sure.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I
what think... a great show.
I think it's unclear.
So, what did you think of the sequence?
I thought it would be cool choreography.
I have problems with it.
I have some answers. What are your problems?
Okay, my problems are that it feels like the Sons of the Harpy goes from being this sort of fringe group to now there's like dozens, if not hundreds of them. It's also not entirely clear exactly how many Unsullied were wounded in this assault. Like, was it – did the show mean to imply that it was, like, hundreds of Unsullied and this was just, like, a small group that we're seeing? Or they just mean to ambush this one group?
I think it was just, like, seven of them.
Yeah, okay. So they just wanted to ambush a few of the Unsullied. It's not like
– well, yeah, they're picking them off with, like, guerrilla tactics.
Gotcha, gotcha.
And someone online made the comparison to the Iraq War again, where they talked about how the army is not the police. So the Unsullied are an army, but they're not the police. And so it's a different sort of way of interacting. And also the book is very clear on the fact that the Unsullied are better in open area type of warfare. And here they're sort of trapped in a narrow space, which is obviously very intentional. Like, the Sons of Harpy lure them in to a place where they're sort of like phalanx, you know, type of, right, of movements are not like doable. So,
right. Right. I guess my issue is like, wow, the Sons of the Harpy went from like being like a couple dudes to now they are like a huge organized force to be reckoned with. I mean, it really does make it seem very expansive.
They got that one prostitute working for them overtime, man.
Yes,
she sucks.
So yeah, what do you think of that? Am I unreasonable in feeling that way? I felt like the transition was really abrupt.
I think it's unclear how large the Sons of the Harpy group is,
right?
But I think that's kind of makes sense because they work in the shadows. You know,
yep.
They take off those gold masks and they're just anyone else. So I think it kind of makes sense that we don't know how many there are in this show version. But I agree that it seemed like a small force that Danny had to deal with. And now it sort of feels more overwhelming.
Yeah. Like, it feels like they outnumber the Unsullied. At least it did in this episode.
But I don't think that's the case. I think they're correct, luring small groups and picking them off.
Makes sense. Makes sense. So any other thoughts about the way this episode ended? Very climactically, because we just don't know if they survived.
I will say another thing, you know, as I mentioned this about Loras, so Barriss and Selmy is like one of the most famous knights. And the show actually, especially in the first season, did a really good job of talking about over and over again what an amazing knight he is. When Ned Stark gets betrayed in the throne room there, and Barristan is sort of demoted from the head of the Kingsguard by Cersei. He has this great line where I think he's talking to Meryn Trant, and he says, "I could cut through all of you like five of you like butter," or something like that. And you believe it because this is the legend of Barristan Selmy.
Right. So are you saying that given that he's such a legend, the fact that he was defeated by these Sons of the Harpy, which presumably aren't super trained,
ragtag. Right. It wasn't the most dignified. We don't know what's going on with Selmy, but, you know, if this is his end, not a very dignified way to go. But, you know, he is older, whatever. You can say whatever you want. He was in a, like, backed into a corner. There are all sorts of things. But I think lovers of the book character are bummed to see this noble knight brought so low by this rabble.
I should also say I was a little bit surprised at the fact that Daenerys continues to not want to reopen the fighting pits, given that, like, given the following, her side piece had told her that this is a good idea to do it. So I thought, oh, maybe that got through to her. And then secondarily, she saw how good it went over when she killed a bunch of dudes. Or she killed that, I'm sorry, what's his name? Mosador last week.
Yeah.
So presumably, she'd want to do something to kind of placate the masses, right?
Right.
But she remained obstinate in her commitment to not having these fighting pits. And the episode intercut that dialogue with scenes of Sons of the Harpy overrunning the Unsullied. I think the show is trying to communicate, hey, like, this is a direct result. You know, A is a direct result, or B is a direct result of A, you know? That, like, the reason Sons of the Harpy are, like, running rampant and killing everyone and doing so with impunity is because Dany has allowed things to get to this point. I get that was the way I interpreted the filmmaking.
I think that's accurate.
Yeah? Okay. Cool. So I'm very curious to see whether or not Barriss Selmy survived and whether or not Grey Worm survived. And yeah, so that's the end of the episode. Any overall thoughts on this episode? It sounds like you were not too hot on it. I really enjoyed it. I really like this episode. Go ahead.
I think the great highs make up for some of the lows. So like the Shireen thing, which really did it for me, and the Tourney of Harrenhal story, those were extremely bright moments for me. So some of the other stuff I'm willing to just sort of move along. I really do have faith that they're going to turn the Sand Snakes thing around, but I will be really disappointed if they don't.
Gotcha. Yeah, overall, yeah, that was a low point for me, the Sand Snakes, but everything else I thought was solid. It was one of my favorite episodes of the first four episodes.
Oh, okay.
Of the first four episodes? Not of the whole
series.
Not of the whole series. But yeah, the way it ends is just nuts. Some great action choreography and so
yeah.
on. So really good stuff. Who didn't we see this week? We didn't see Arya, right?
Yeah.
We didn't see Theon, although we were at Winterfell.
Right.
Anything? And we didn't see Brienne and Pod, as far as I recall, right?
Yes.
So those are the ones we didn't see. So we'll probably catch them next week. I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode, John Robinson. Where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me on VanityFair.com, where we got a whole bunch of really cool Star Wars photos, including Gwendolyn Christie, who looks badass. You can find me on Twitter at JoeRothis. You can listen to me talk about spoilers, Game of Thrones spoilers, on Storm of Spoilers podcast.
Come see my film, The Primary Instinct, at the Seattle International Film Festival at SIFF.net. And it's playing at the end of May. I will be there along with the subject of my film, Stephen Tobolowsky. Hope to see you guys there in Seattle. Thanks for listening to A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys next week.